Very good. Okay,
today we're going to start talking about the problem of gene recognition, which is a different kind of a problem than we've talked about before. So let's start there. First of all, are there any questions? The last couple of classes we were talking about homology recognition, okay, meaning sequence similarity testing. Before that, we were looking at sort of sequence assembly. Okay, and so we're still going to continue the general theme of working with analyzing sequences. The difference is sort of what we are actually going to be doing with it. Okay, sort of the problem of gene recognition is the problem of sort of identifying sort of biologically interesting features in a DNA sequence. Okay, any questions about this or anything else we've talked? Anything we've talked about so far? Any questions from last time? Follow up on. Okay, so the situation we have from basically our last classes is that we have now gotten to the point where we have sequenced literally 100 different genomes and portions of, you know, probably a million different sequences at this point. All kinds of different organisms, all kinds of different structures. And what we'd like to now do is look at the question of what we would call annotation. Namely, given the DNA sequence, how do you identify what are biologically interesting features? So right now, do we have any chalk? Okay. You know, when I interpret a DNA sequence, at least when it's the genome's been sequenced, I interpret it as this long string of characters. The act of annotation is to try to identify what regions on this DNA sequence are particularly interesting to biologists. Okay? So what might be things that are interesting to biologists? The most important example is probably the genes. Okay, the genes we've said are protein coding, or the regions of the genome that code for proteins. Okay, clearly we're built from proteins. Clearly we want to understand proteins. Okay, so trying to identify where in this long text are the genes is clearly an important problem. And it's complicated by several feature problems. One of which is how relatively rare the genes are. Okay, remember in the human genome, you have a world where roughly 2% of the DNA codes for genes. These are part of genes. The rest of it is other stuff. Okay, so you're looking for trying to identify. And think of it as you're given a long text and you want to identify the 1 or 2% that is interesting. Okay, maybe it's like what you do when you take notes in my class. You're listening to me and you want to find out what are the 1 or 2% of what I say that is interesting. Okay? So what is interesting? So genes are interesting because they make proteins. Other things that are interesting are what we call promoter regions. Okay? So as we'll discuss the structure of genes a little bit more lately. But among the other things that's also interesting in genes, interesting biologically, are some of the regions upstream from genes. Okay? As you'll see them when we talk a little bit more about how genes get expressed, okay, there are binding sites, typically a little bit upstream from each gene, okay, that tells you when that gene is turned on and turned off. And you would like to be able to recognize those sites automatically. Those are regions of interest. What other features? What other features might be interesting to annotate? If I give you raw sequence, what other things on the genome might you want to sort of be able to annotate? Cancer-causing genes is not so much an annotation as it is an interpretation. So right now, what I'm doing in annotation is the first step of taking the DNA sequence and parsing it, if you wish. Okay? So I just want to know, I don't want to, at least at this point, I'm not so worried about what does this gene do. I want to identify the relevant features that are there. Okay? So knowing whether a gene causes cancer or something, that's a higher screen level of analysis than we're right now interested in doing. Okay? features, genomic features, are probably of interest? I don't know yet. So one thing, we will talk about the structure of genes today, but we'll learn that genes are actually more complicated entities than just sort of linear strands of proteins. So there's questions about some of the internal structures of genes that you'll want to be able to mark. That's important. What other things might you want to annotate automatically and have some help for? So one question that would be nice is whether some genes code for proteins, some genes code for RNAs, which means that they are structural elements that are not proteins. Okay, you'd like people to recognize them as well. Okay, I'm not really going to talk too much about that today, but that's something you'd like to recognize. We've talked about that there's repeat regions, AT, AT, AT. You'd like to be able to identify boring parts of the genome as well, and say, well, from here to here it's boring, you probably don't want to look at it, okay, or it's a repeat, okay? Or you might want to identify approximate repeats, because maybe what's the case is you have one region here and one region here that seem to be duplicates, okay, or almost duplicates. There's changes, there's mutations, there's differences between them, but they're largely similar. And you probably want to be able to, in the course of automatically analyzing your sequence, you'd like to mark regions of interest. So duplicate regions, okay, are interesting. I'm going to say duplicate regions is, I think of repeats as being small things that happen again and again. Sometimes there's larger blocks of sequence that are repeated. And you'd like to know about that if that exists. So basically the problem with sequence annotation is taking as input a raw DNA sequence, A, T, C, T, 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 G, and then identifying interesting features. Parsing it, again, if you're a computer scientist, it might not be unreasonable to think of the annotation problem as in some sense parsing the genome, okay, and try to identify things that are there. So, the reasons why, in general, we care about identifying genes and promoter sites is that's the place where the action happens, okay? That somehow that if you're a drug company, you care about genes because the functioning parts of, the components that you're built from that are interacting, okay, inside you are basically proteins. So you want to have a complete parts list of the organism that you're studying. So it should be clear that genes are a reasonable thing to study. These promoter sites upstream of the genes sort of tell you when is that gene going to be turned on and turned off. So recognizing those promoter sites is very important, because maybe you have a disease you're trying to attack, which is the result of not expressing enough of this protein. Okay? Maybe what you need to do is not so much look at the protein. Your protein might be correct, but this person might have something wrong with the binding site upstream, so the gene doesn't get turned on or turned off at the right time. Okay, and so recognizing these kind of features is sort of important computationally. And again, it's now an important thing. If you're doing a genome sequencing project, it may take you several years, several million dollars to do a sequencing project. To publish the results, you want to, at the end, publish a paper in a journal. These days, when you publish a paper in a journal, you can't say, hey, I sequenced this genome, and it's in this database, you look at it. You're sort of expected, as part of the article announcing the sequence, to have done some analysis of it. Where are the genes? How are these genes interesting? And so, in part of any sequencing team is going to be a computational annotation team, okay, that runs the sequence through various gene recognition programs and things like that. So the biologist can start to identify interesting things and figure out how the organism works. Any questions? It should be clear, annotation is an important job, and we have to do it. So, but this job is a little bit different computationally than the ones that we've talked about so far. If you think about it, gene recognition is a pattern recognition problem. Okay, it's not a well-defined algorithmic problem to the extent that sequence analysis, sequence similarity was a well-defined problem. Find all approximate matches satisfying this definition is a well-defined algorithmic problem.
Finding old genes is not by itself a well-defined problem. Because, first of all, genes are defined by nature, not by a computer scientist. If you're going to write a program to recognize genes that a computer scientist or an algorithms person is going to be happy with, you really need to give them a mathematical definition of what a gene is and what it isn't. And such definitions are not known and probably don't really exist. Okay? There is some debate among biologists about, for example, there's a big debate as to how many genes there are in the human. Okay, even after the human genome has been sequenced for a couple of years, it is still not known exactly how many genes there are in humans. And there is actually a fairly wide debate as to, it's not a question of is the number 40,706 or 40,707. It's a difference of 10,000, 20,000 between people, what people think. Some people think there's a lot more genes that haven't been discovered. Some people think that, in fact, there's a relatively small number of genes and we know them all. Okay? So the question of gene recognition is still an open problem, okay, to do as well as you can. And one reason it's open is because it's a fuzzy kind of a thing. Okay, it's not well defined. It's like writing a program to predict the outcome of the stock market. That's a good pattern recognition problem. There are programs that do a pretty good job, but programs are not perfect. Okay, and you know, if you give them hard enough cases, they fail. Okay, so we're now living in a world, a messier world than we had lived in before. Okay, but that's life. Any questions about gene recognition? Okay. So before we try to recognize genes, let's look at the some of the biology of what is it that genes do. Okay? And just the step, phase step called translation. We know that, as we've mentioned before, the central dogma is that DNA codes for RNA, codes for proteins. So there is one step in the act of a gene getting processed, called translation, where the relevant portion of the DNA is translated on an essentially base-by-base basis into RNA. So what happens is once you have the RNA, there is a complex molecule called a ribosome. You hear a ribosome is being talked about as a molecular machine. This ribosome is a think about it as a processor that takes as input an RNA molecule, and one base by one base, or one triple by one triple, slides the RNA molecule along the ribosome, okay, and sort of positions things so that another component can dock with it. This is at least how I will interpret how a ribosome works. Okay, that you have a machine, little molecule that takes an input of the RNA, sort of like a tape. It's going to take the RNA and slide it through one base at a time, or one triple at a time. And it's got a docking station where the three RNA bases are exposed of a triple. And it's designed that components called tRNAs, called transfer RNAs, are little components that, if I think about it, if you think about it this way, they have two ends. One end is a binding site for a particular triple of RNA, a codon. And on the other side is a holder, a docking station, for an amino acid. So these transfer RNAs, if you think about it conceptually, there are 64 of them, different kinds. And these are little machines that on one side have the recognition sites for a triple, and on the other side have a particular amino acid corresponding to that triple. So what happens is these transfer RNAs are banging around. When they happen to dock in here, this binding site will match with those three exposed RNA bases. The rest of the docking station puts the amino acid in the right position. And so as the RNA slides through this tape,
A protein string is being filled one amino acid at a time. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay? About how that process works? Many of the biologists want to complain about anything I said as being untrue. I'm sure it's simplified. You didn't want to say to me that I said it's untrue. Okay? I will certainly listen to complaints. Okay?
What is it you say, say that simple? Say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So how does it take it to classify it as 1, 2, 3, or 2, 3, 4?
Okay, so one question, I think what you're saying is how does it know to start? We agree that in reading this tape, this RNA tape, it makes sense to read it three bases at a time. I can kind of believe that you bind something, you spit out three bases. You move and tape in the RNA in three bases. One thing that seems to be a problem is how do you know where to start? Okay? And the answer is that, as we'll look at a little bit more when we talk about the definition of genes, there are start signals to help recognize these things. Okay? But it's a little bit mysterious exactly how it works. Okay? But there are definitely start signals. There's a start signal. Every gene starts with the same amino acid. Okay, simple. There's a three-base starting pattern. Exons and introns have starting and ending patterns. So there's some patterns there to be recognized. But exactly how it works is somewhat mysterious. Okay, or at least mysterious to me. Any questions? So one thing that I think is important when I think about the biology, the biology or the chemistry of this kind of a thing, is to realize that what's going on is the result of molecules banging into each other in a more or less random fashion. Okay? So part of you wants to say, oh, this is a machine, you have to feed it with input and stuff like that. Basically, the thing to remember is that you've got molecules, and these molecules are banging around largely by chance, by the random method. So the way I interpret it is that this ribosome molecule, it has the RNA coming in. There's three exposed bases here. In this soup of molecules mixing around, among them are these transfer RNAs, which will bind nicely with this. And when one of them accidentally bumps into this, another base can then get locked into position. Okay? So to me, it's kind of amazing that this works largely by random chance and electrostatic forces and things like that. There's nothing driving this that says, you know, go make RNA now. A lot of it is just, go make proteins now. Okay? A lot of it is just molecules banging and binding. Okay? Any questions? Okay? And so the way to think about this ribosome and this machine is there's an input tape, which is the RNA. There is an output tape, which is the protein that is being built one residue at a time. Okay? And at some point, that tape is going to have an end signal, at which point the RNA, the protein falls off, and that's the end. Then we finish making that protein molecule. Any questions about that?
Yes.
So the question is, are these RNA sequences reusable? And the answer is yes. Okay, although they eventually degrade. So the way I think of it is that you've got this RNA sequence that is reading through on the tape. There is nothing to prevent multiple ribosomes from working on the same RNA sequence at the same time. Okay, they sort of start at one end, and they bind at one end, and then the RNA starts walking through it. There is no priori reason why you can't have multiple copies of the protein being made simultaneously. Okay? The RNA can survive, potentially might survive reuse. But eventually, it gets degraded. So there are various recycling mechanisms built into the cell. Okay? And so the RNA does not stay around forever. Okay? Eventually it gets broken back down onto its nuclear basis and gets recycled. Okay? So how long does an RNA live? I will say it's on the order of minutes. Okay? as opposed to years or opposed to tenths of a second. But the exact timing here is, you know, maybe a little bit mysterious. Okay, any questions? Okay.
So what else do we know? We basically know that, again, things work by things banging together. That, I think, is the important thing. Now, genes in higher organisms, okay, well, you prokaryotes or lower organisms, okay, things like, bacteria would be prokaryotes. Eukaryotes are higher organisms, and gene structures in higher organisms, okay, and by higher organisms we talk about, certain bacteria, any multi-celled organism would be certainly a eukaryote, okay? In genes, in these higher organisms are not linear sequences, okay? One of the sort of big mysteries and surprises is that the genes are really represented as blocks of coding sequence with intermediate sort of junk DNA or non-coding DNA between them. The exons are the part of the genes that code for proteins. The introns are the stuff that somehow has to get removed. Okay? So when you're trying to do gene prediction in a higher organism, you have to realize that basically it goes through another phase than what we've been talking about. There is a copying phase, okay, where the messenger RNA is copied, okay, and then there is a splicing phase where these introns are removed, and once the introns are removed, then it can be translated into a protein. Okay? So the ribosome is in some sense working on the spliced version of the RNA. Okay? And there is some molecular mechanism to remove these introns, which is, I think, a little bit mysterious. Okay? It's not clear exactly how or why this works well enough that you can, certainly it's not clear well enough how the cell is recognizing these things, that you can build a program based on some sort of biological theory of how this thing works. My interpretation of how splicing works, okay,
would be something like this. You have this messenger RNA molecule that's being built. Somehow this messenger RNA molecule folds on itself, okay, and the introns sort of fold on themselves, okay, forming some secondary structure, which is then cut off, okay, to form the messenger RNA. Okay? So somehow nature is able to recognize where these introns and exons are, because this is a process that happens reliably. Exactly what nature is looking at to do that is not completely known. Okay? So that's a problem we have to deal with. Okay? So when you're trying to do gene recognition in humans or any higher organism, it's not enough to just look for where the coding regions are. They really want to know, not only saying, oh, in this portion of the genome it looks like there's a gene, you'd like to know where each region starts and stops. Okay? Any questions?
Yes.
Excuse me?
The introns and exons are RNA.
Well, I guess what I would say is the precursor and messenger RNA is a one-for-one copy of a region of the DNA. So it's equivalent, since the DNA sequence, the genome sequence, is really what we have that we're annotating, it's fair to say that we're looking for the introns and exons in the genomic DNA. Okay? That's where they are to be found. Okay? And we would like to identify those species. Any questions? Okay? And the question of why these introns and exons exist, why genes don't sit in one piece, is somewhat of a mystery. Okay? I mean, if I were designing things, I would like to think that I would, if I wanted to make a protein, it would be much simpler that there not have to be the splicing mechanism. Okay, it seems like if you, you know, just wanted to build proteins without introns, it would seem like a better idea. And certainly prokaryotes seem to be able to do just fine with that. Now, there are a couple of reasons why introns are potentially important, okay, or important, and why they might exist. One thing is that the ability to have genes that come in pieces enables genes to evolve quicker, okay? So suppose, let's say, you want to, you find some way to a mutation comes along and breaks the recognition site for the second exon. Maybe one mutation might cause this whole piece, one little white mutation might be enough to break whatever it is that nature is doing to recognize the boundaries of that exon. And maybe it will get spliced out after that mutation. So if you have your genes exist in small pieces, okay, it's easier to sort of evolve different proteins by shuffling them around, okay, than if you have one long monolithic thing. Okay? You can remove pieces of it relatively easily. So that's one reason why they probably exist. There is some debate as to whether or not it is the case that life at the beginning started with exons and introns. Did the first life have split genes or not? Okay? And in some sense, it would seem like, since the lower organisms do not have split genes, it might make sense, it would seem like a natural theory might be to say, well, you know, more complicated gene structures emerged in higher organisms, so they had to do more complicated things. Some other scientists look at the question differently and say that one thing that bacteria turns out have an advantage to have short genomes because they have to reproduce very rapidly. So maybe it is the case that the early life, actually all organisms had introns, and gradually that got evolved away because it was more important for simple organisms to have simpler genomes so they could reproduce more rapidly. Okay? Any questions or comments from that? Including from anyone who knows anything to say anything. Yes?
How much time does it take to reproduce and
So, okay, my understanding, and again, I'm willing to be... my understanding is that these things happen on the order of seconds. Okay? So I guess what I would say is that the act of copying, you know, when the RNA polymerase copies from the DNA, okay, this region, this reading happens on the order of seconds in a typical, you know, in a typical reasonable sized gene. It's not months, it's not days, okay? It's not hours. Okay, it's also not milliseconds, as I understand. Okay, and similarly, the act of translation, okay, actually going from the, you know, from the RNA to the protein, that also happens on the order of seconds. Okay, just for a rough time scale. Although I learned that there are some proteins that are incredibly long, for which this will take much longer. Okay, any questions? Yes. Okay, so the question is, what is the difference between transfer RNA and messenger RNA? Okay? As was alluded to earlier, when we looked at what features we might want to annotate the genome for, we said that there were some genes that were for coding for proteins, and some genes that code for RNAs. Okay? RNA is a molecule. Okay? Its biggest use, as far as I am concerned, okay, is that it is used as this intermediary between DNA and protein. But the important thing to see is that RNA is just a chemical, okay, and there are other uses of this chemical in the cell. So mRNA, or messenger RNA, is the name that is used for denoting the copy of a gene that is going to be converted into a protein. The other thing that's true is that RNA also has structural roles in the cell. Most things in the cell are built from proteins, but not all of them. The ribosome, this machine that translates RNA into protein, is part made out of proteins and part made out of RNA. Remember, RNA is a molecule that folds up into a particular shape. That shape may very well be interesting. Okay? So the transfer RNAs are these little pieces of RNA that fold up into a particular cell shape.
There is a transfer RNA, okay, carefully drawn, which has two exposed parts to it. One is for holding an amino acid, and one is for binding with the ribosome, okay? So the RNA template, the exposed part of the RNA goes with the ribosome. So this is a little molecule made out of RNA. There is a gene that describes how to make it. Okay, but this is not a protein coding gene, this is an RNA coding gene. So most of what I'll talk about today is for protein coding genes. Okay? But we realize that there are RNAs that are also have to describe how to make these interesting RNAs, okay, in the genome. And so there are genes that describe how to make them too. Any questions?
Okay. Good. So that's basically the notion that we have. So transcription is the process of copying the portion of the DNA containing a gene into RNA. The transcription and translation, and I always get them confused. One of them, as far as I'm concerned, is going from DNA to RNA. One of them is from going from RNA to protein. Okay? Now, if you're going to be doing the transcription part, where you're going from the DNA to RNA, you need to have something, some signals on the DNA sequence that is going to tell you where the genes start and stop. Okay? So somehow the way I think of what's happening is the following.
That on your DNA sequence, your genomic DNA sequence, somewhat upstream from the gene that you're actually translating, are these various binding sites, okay? Typically, about 10 to 35 bases upstream. There is of any gene, there is a binding site for a molecule called RNA polymerase. Once this molecule binds to the DNA sequence, okay, that is where the copying process starts. Okay? And so the copying process starts from here, okay, until after the coding part of the gene. Okay? There is some kind of a structure that causes the RNA polymerase to fall off. Typically the end of the copying is marked by a tail of all A's. Okay, so you sometimes hear about a poly A tail at the end of the gene. Okay? Yes?
But the poly A is not up.
That you're saying is in after.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
It's not in the genome.
Okay. True. Okay, that's pretty good. Okay? What is in the genomic data is the following. What kind of signals do we have? We have these binding sites for the polymerase to start. Yes?
Can you recognize these binding sites in specific patterns?
Well, there are specific patterns, but not very well conserved patterns. So these binding sites are typically very short patterns. I will say on the order of 5 to 10 bases. Okay? And they are not exact patterns. Okay? So it is not, you know, somehow that if a base is there, if the bases change a little bit, that's okay. Okay? Sometimes it will still stay. Okay? So that upstream region is not enough to look for a gene. Okay? Yes?
Are there
any
enzymes or polymerase, the RNA polymerase?
RNA polymerase is, I believe, the basic enzyme
that copies, that has the job of copying from DNA to RNA. Okay, so that's the enzyme that starts the process. Okay? So there is one, for the copying to occur, The RNA polymerase has to bind. Now the trouble is but, as I understand it, there are, well, we have to look at how genes get expressed. There are a bunch of different binding sites,
okay,
that operate and do different things.
Okay?
So the way that I think of gene expression is happening is that, again, upstream from the gene is a collection of possible binding sites. Various molecules are bumping into this DNA sequence. DNA is just a molecule itself. Things are bumping into it. Certain things will make it easier for the RNA polymerase to bind.
Okay?
That will make this reaction happen more often and faster. Certain other things block it from going further.
Okay?
So depending upon what molecules bind upstream or not upstream, it will either trigger or inhibit this process.
Okay?
But once the process gets started, it retreats.
Okay?
Until it eventually falls off.
Okay?
Any questions? Okay?
Good. Any other questions? Yes. The answer is yes. Do genes overlap each other? The answer is yes.
There is nothing to stop a gene from getting... There are lots of ugly things that can happen to genes. Okay? There is nothing that happens to stop... Here you have one set of triples coding for a gene. There is no reason why the same DNA sequence might not be interpreted by shifting over by one and having another gene encoded there. There is no reason why you can't have genes on both the upper and lower strand of the DNA. So remember, DNA exists as a double-stranded molecule, right? The actual reading of the genes, as I interpret, happens at times when there is a sort of a temporary split between the upper and lower strand.
Okay?
So as I interpret it, you've got this double-stranded molecule that occasionally opens up in portions. At certain times, opens up in portions. And now you've got an upper part and a lower part, both of which are exposed. And maybe something's going to bunk into it and start reading it that way. Or bunk into it and start reading it that way.
Okay?
And so you're going to have genes on both the upper and lower strands. And they can overlap each other. Or you can even have multiple genes overlapping each other on the same strand.
Okay?
Yes? Can the introns of one gene be the contain exons of another gene? And the answer is, as far as I know, yes.
Okay?
I would certainly assume that that's the case. I have no reason to believe it's not the case.
Okay?
So, that is another potential problem. Any questions?
So, there may be also binding sites
inside genes? See, part of it, as I would say, is there may be binding sites within genes.
Part of it is a question of interpretation of what a sequence is. So if you think about it, let's say you're looking at the big pattern on a disk.
Okay,
you have a computer disk.
Okay?
Somewhere there's files start, you know, start of blocks and end of blocks for text on a disk.
Okay?
Now if I gave you a hard disk, I cut it out of a machine and asked you to hold this under a microscope and read the bits.
Okay?
Somehow the bits are encoded on a disk. Exactly what the meaning of those bits are is something about, has something to do with the formatting of the, you know, basically how the whole disk system was put together.
Okay?
If you understand my analogy.
Okay?
So the way I interpret it, you interpret the DNA sequence, you know, DNA sequence as a sequence of bits.
Okay?
Based on certain signals.
Okay?
These signals start to read from here. And from here to here is going to be a gene. There is no reason why that same pattern couldn't occur here and represent the code, the binding site for some other gene.
Okay?
It's just sort of a pattern, you know, these are just sort of a sequence of letters. Okay? And when the DNA sequence, the genomic DNA sequence is open, things are going to start binding with it. It might bind here, it might bind there. That might determine which gene gets expressed. You have a very messy situation. Any questions? Okay, so it's a validated situation. That's sort of the important thing to see here. That we're looking for signals.
The signals are in some sense there because nature knows how to do it. Okay? But it's not obvious, you know, to us how it's working. Certainly not obvious to me how it's working. Okay? So what else do we have to do? Basically, we have to look for those kind of signals. So how do we now, knowing that the problem is very messy, how on earth can we hope to recognize genes in a DNA sequence? Okay? The first thing to know is that introns, in general, are flanked by what we call donor and acceptor sites. Okay? So every intron starts with a GT and ends with an AG, in general. Okay? So this gives you some kind of a feature to look for if you're trying to identify genes, right? Or identify where introns and exons start.
Certainly. If you think there's a gene in a particular region, you know, one of the first things that you want to do is to try to identify where are the GTs and where are the AGs. Because all the introns are going to basically be spanning that. Okay? So that gives you some kind of a signal to look for. The trouble is it's a very weak signal. Why is that? What's the probability that a random sequence is going to have a GT? Well, that's 4 times 4, 16 possibilities for two base symbols.
Basically, there's a 1 in 16 probability that at any point you put your finger in the genome, you're going to see a GT. Okay? And so GTs and ATs happen by chance very, very often. Okay? So you can't just use this to predict where the introns are, but it gives you a start. Another feature you have is that genes start with, okay, a ATG. Okay, there's a start codon for every gene. And a stop codon. Okay? So every gene, remember, has to know where it starts and where it stops. So you can use the start symbol to know that basically the probability that you get an ATG is one out of 64 at any given finger. Okay? So this is a somewhat rarer signal, but still very common. Likewise, you can look for, stop symbols. They'll happen roughly every 20 codons, you will see, is a stop symbol. Okay? Yeah?
But if I'm not wrong,
you use
the sequence is random.
I'm assuming the sequence is random. And that's not completely true. But it's, so certainly the genome is not a random sequence. But it's a messy sequence, okay? So the answer is there are lots of GTs and AGs sitting there. There's lots of ATGs and a lot of these things sitting there as well, okay? But the genome is not random, and that's also true. Okay, yes?
So if you have a thing, you can just write up, and you can
say
that's the
genome,
and you have a repetition in the sequence.
When I have repetition in the sequence? No, I don't see why. So one thing that's true is that I can identify, obviously interesting things should look for, if I want to propose a candidate for a gene.
My gene should look something like this. There should be the start codon someplace. There should be a stop codon someplace. You know, A-R-T-A-A. If I'm going to have introns, the introns I cut out should basically start with GT and end with AG. So certainly this is what my genes are going to look like. But those are basically very weak conditions still. So if you say report all places on the genome where there's a pattern ATG followed someplace by a pattern, you know, stop codon, where inside there's a certain number of GTAT combinations, you will get a tremendous number and get swamped by most things that are not genes.
Also, my conclusion is that in your exome, they're going to have, I mean, you take the optimum frame, you have to be optimum. And so, in the option that in the frame, they make you don't want to find any of those.
So one thing that's very important, and a very important feature, which he's mentioning now, is that of an open reading frame. So suppose, let's say I want to recognize a gene. Let's say we're dealing with a lower organ, so we don't have split genes to worry about. Suppose you have a gene of, let's say, 100 amino acids. Okay? It's going to start with a triple. There's then going to be 100 triples. Followed by a stop codon, right? What do we know about this intervening region here? If this is a gene of length 100, 100 amino acids, we know there cannot have been a stop codon in any one of those 100 spots. Does everybody agree with that? So the stop codon says stop. Okay, that means, and it means stop. Okay? So what does that argue about? Since most of the proteins we're talking about are large proteins, or larger than about 20 amino acids, we are looking for a large reading. What strong signal in the gene? Is there a long sequence which starts at one point where if you interpret it as triples, you do not get a stop codon? Okay? So, you hear people, biologists talk a lot about ORFs. What is an ORF? It's an open reading frame. Okay? And one of the good signals for when you have a gene is, does there exist a stretch on the genome where when you interpret it this way, you do not see a stop codon? By chance, you would expect to see a stop codon every 20 or so triples. If you go 50, 100 triples without a stop codon, this is probably interesting. So a lot of people, when they talk about genes, the initial annotation is, a lot of their job is looking for long open reading frames as being something that is significant. Okay? Because these are things that probably evolved to get rid of the stop codons in order to make large proteins. Any questions? Yes?
Yeah. Are there
valid proteins that begin with GT? The answer is certainly.
Okay. I mean, certainly GTs are valid subsequences in proteins. Okay. All genes start with this particular ATG, but there's no reason why the next basis couldn't be GT. Followed by another symbol coding for a protein. No, GTs happen very, very often. And so you can't just look on the GTs. But one study that is useful is to look for these long coding, these long open reading frames. Another thing that's true about genes is that the coding regions, the sum of the coding regions, must be a multiple of 3. Okay? So if you have a split gene,
what other feature that you have is that if you're going to tell me that this is a gene, and that here I've got GTs and HCs, you know, starting and stopping things, it had better be the case that the product, the sum of what you get left, is a multiple of 3, so I can properly interpret it as a gene.
Okay? So these are things that I can use to help code for proteins. Yes?
It is certain that it will not have a stop codon in the middle of it.
It is certain that it will not have a stop codon in the middle of a gene when interpreted as in its proper frame. So realize that a gene is, the right way to interpret a gene is as a triple, is as a sequence of base triples, a sequence of codons. It is certification of what's the start of the gene. And before you get to the end of this exon, if you interpret it as triples, then none of these will be one of the three triples that corresponds to an end of a stop codon. On the other hand, there is no reason why the last character of one codon and the next two characters could very well be a stop codon. It's just not being interpreted, it's interpreted in another frame, and that's, there's nothing wrong with that. But in the frame that we're reading, you're not going to see any stop codons there. Okay?
Any other questions?
Okay. So, one final sort of good news feature, or feature that you might want to worry about, is that there is a statistical difference between the base compositions, in the compositions of things inside genes and outside genes. Okay? So the way that I think about it is that in a...
if you look at in the genome of an organism, there's relatively small portions that are genes that are doing interesting things. Most of it is this non-coding region that is junk, okay, that you can change it and the organism doesn't really care. So over millions of years of evolution, the region between genes, if a mutation happened and you suddenly came to C to a D, nobody cared. Okay? So between the genes, there have been enough random mutation that it should be the case that this stuff is relatively random. Okay? But on the other hand, stuff between genes, the covering of genes is important. Okay? And so we would expect there to be some statistical properties of the coding sequences within genes. In particular, we know that organisms tend to prefer certain codons to other codons. So what do we know? We know proteins are made out of amino acids. Some amino acids are more popular than other ones. Okay? Some are rarer, some are more common. Okay? So we would expect to see more codons associated with the plentiful amino acids. Things that appear a lot in proteins. Okay? Further, we know that because there needs to be a transfer RNA between each triple and the amino acid, in certain species, have different amounts of each type of transfer RNA. So certain species have a preference, a codon bias, it is called, that their coding regions will be more likely to have this triple than some other triple. And so once you understand the coding bias of a particular organism, you know something about what triples it wants to appear in and what six words like to appear in genes. That will help you tell where the genes are. Okay? Any questions? What's a little bit of a circular argument there, though, that I just made?
Yeah? You have
to know probability distribution in order to identify the genes, and yet it would seem that I don't even know where the genes are in order to identify the probability distribution. Okay? So typically what happens is if you would do a, you know, some genes are relatively easy to recognize. Maybe they have the ones corresponding to the very big horse, the long open reading frame. And from those, you start to build some kind of a probability distribution. And then use that to try to find the harder genes. Once you get better knowledge of these probability distributions, you can try to find the harder genes. Okay, the harder to locate genes there. Any questions? Okay?
So all told, we have a certain number of features that are available. Certain signals that are on the sequence of the gene, that are on the DNA, okay, donor and acceptor sites and promoter binding sites. We know that there are certain start and stop signals within genes themselves.
We know that there is a triplet condition, so we're looking for multiple of three. We know that there are certain biases as far as what triples appear within proteins and what don't. And we know that there are open reading frames, okay, that a long open reading frame is probably interesting. Together we have a lot of features that are, you know, in principle, by combining them in some way, you might have some hope to recognize genes, okay? Even though no single one of these is a killer identifier, guaranteed identification of the gene. Maybe by combining them, you can hope to find something. Any questions? Yeah. So are the properties the same for all organisms? Well, different organisms are going to have different biases of which codons it uses. So in fact, when you look at a gene, in general, the gene prediction programs that you'll see are customized by organism. So when you go and you want to predict genes in an organism, the ones that do a better job are the ones that know what organism you're looking at. Okay, they'll know something about, if you say you want to do gene prediction in yeast, they will know something about the coding distribution of yeast. Okay? So things like the codon bias is a function of the organism. Things like the start and stop signal within genes are pretty universal. So these are universal across organisms. Okay? So it's sort of a mixture of some things that are common and some are universal and some things that aren't. Yes? There's not, my understanding, the question is how similar is codon bias? Hopefully in a couple classes when I show you the results of doing some gene recognition, we'll look at some codon bias things. But sometimes you hear genomes, people will talk about in a genome, the GC content of a genome. Okay? So the GC content would be what fraction of the bases are G's or C's. If genomes were random, what would we expect the GC content of a genome to be? What? 50%, right? So you have a choice of A, a C, a G, or a T. 50% of them are the bases should be G's and C's. And if you look at a long enough string, if you did it randomly, you're going to get something very close to 50%. But if you look at real genomes, the GC content varies fairly widely. I'm going to guess from like 30% to 60%, okay? Something in that range, okay? So there are strong biases. Different species have strong biases about what they are, you know, what the strings will look like, okay? Nearby species will have similar biases, but that range from sort of 30 to 60 is something that shows up, for example, in bacteria. So bacteria is a diverse enough group that it has wide varieties in GC content. Okay? So the codon distribution in different bacteria varies wildly. Okay, in mammals, I don't think there are enough mammals that have been sequenced that you can really make a strong case that the GC content, how widely it varies among mammals. Okay, but among bacteria it varies quite wildly. Any questions? Okay? So that makes it, we can use those features to make gene prediction, to give us some hope that we can build gene prediction programs. On the other hand, there are problems, more complexities that we have to build into these gene recognition programs. One problem that is true is that because of evolution, we know that there are, in mutation and evolution and things like that, there are copies of genes inserted, okay, copies of DNA, sometimes get inserted into genomes. So here might be a particular genome at some point, and evolutionary mutation might insert another copy of a copy of a portion of the strand back into the sequence. There are a bunch of different ways where these mutations might happen. If this copy thing happened to become a gene, now the organism has two copies of the gene. Okay, and can in principle make the protein from either this gene or that gene.
this might be a good thing for the organism. So you could imagine that such mutations might be selected for. On the other hand, sometimes what happens is after the knocking event, there's going to be mutations. And as time goes by, these copies are going to diverge. Okay? And so there's going to start to be differences between the genes here and the gene there. And eventually, maybe a mutation will come and insert a stop codon in one of the copies. So this gene is no longer functional. Now you've got a world where you've got two coding sequences, both of which will have very similar base compositions, both of which will be multiples of 3 in length, let's say. Okay? And yet, one is going to work and one isn't going to work. Okay? So one thing that you've got to be careful about,
okay, programs that have to do is distinguish what we'll call broken genes, which are pseudogenes, from real functioning genes. Okay? And so this is a complicated problem. Okay? Any questions about why these things happen? Okay? Yeah.
How do these copying events happen? In a sense of, on a per reproduction scheme, not very often, but so in the sense of, how often is it the case that, I have a daughter. Does my daughter have two copies of a gene that got inserted because there was a mutation, between her and me? And the answer is almost certainly not. But on the other hand, if you operate over millions of generations, even if the probability of one of these events happening is very small, as time goes by, you will accumulate a lot of these events. Okay? And so, in fact, these copying and rearrangement operations are very, very important in evolution. Because one good thing is, suppose say you have a gene that is critical for life, okay? Your hemoglobin gene. You don't have hemoglobin, you die, okay? That is a bad thing for evolution to play with, right? Because if you do a mutation, any mutation to that gene will most likely break it. And once you have a critical gene, it seems hard to evolve it further to make it better. But what happens if you have a duplication event? And now the species that the genome has two hemoglobin genes. Now what if that evolution can play around with and insert things and mutate things without killing the organism? And it might very well make a better hemoglobin molecule that way. So in fact, gene duplication is an important thing for improving protein. Okay? And so gene duplication and pseudogenes are things that happen a lot. Okay? Not a lot in the sense of between you and your parents, but a lot between yeast and me. Okay? Any questions? Yes.
So another source of it is organisms that are the result of, let's say, sexual reproduction.
It is typically the case that you've got a chromosome for this, a copy of each chromosome you're getting, one from your mother and one from your father. Okay? And so that also provides some room for maneuvering. Okay? So that you could have a gene that is, essential. You don't have a copy of this gene, a working copy of this gene, you die. Okay? If you get it from mommy or daddy, that's good enough. Okay? There's certain inherited diseases that are very rare, things that are important, things like Tay Sachs. Okay? It's a gene that affects the Ashkenazi Jewish population. That if both parents are carriers for it. If you happen to inherit the defective gene for both parents, then the child dies. Okay? So you do get some redundancy in the situation when you've got copies from two different parents. Some organisms do not have sexual reproduction, so they don't get two copies. And some chromosomes are different. Like there's an X and Y chromosome that one comes from the mother and one comes from the father. You don't get reproduction, you don't get redundancy there. So there are a lot of diseases that are linked to the X or Y chromosome, because if you get a bad gene on one copy of the bad gene, you don't get a second shot at it. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So that does provide another mechanism for redundancy. Okay?
So sort of distinguishing working and broken genes is important. Another thing that makes life complicated is from time to time there are sequencing errors. Okay? So you can imagine that if you have a sequencing error where one base is deleted, suddenly that's going to cause a frame shift in your apparent protein, right?
Suppose you're trying to recognize this gene, and there is one little base deletion here. Okay? You made a mistake, you sequenced somehow, you lost that base. Well, now you're relying on codon's frame shift errors. You know, now it's no longer going to line up right. Now you're going to have stop codons probably occurring very quickly here. It's not for real. Okay? So you've got to somehow
build enough redundancy in the situation that you don't get distracted by a single sequencing error. Another thing that is a big problem, and something that I find kind of amazing, is that when I think about these split genes,
it is not the case that these split genes are all, the exons are very close to each other. Okay? It's not the case that you live in a world where there's a lot of decoding regions, there's maybe short gaps between them. These introns can be thousands of bases long. So if you're looking for a gene, okay, the case of these exons could be relatively small, they could be relatively far apart. So you cannot sort of say, okay, this is why looking for this donor and acceptor sites are not very helpful. We said that roughly every 16 positions will be a donor or acceptor site. If there's thousands of bases between exons, that's a very weak signal to base to make a decision on. Okay? So that makes life more complicated.
As we talked before, genes can overlap each other. They can appear in different reading frames on different strands. You've got to deal with that. And finally, modern gene recognition programs try to recognize not only the exons, but how they're spliced together. In many genes
that are built up from exons, okay, sometimes the proteins will, the exons are basically assembled left to right, but sometimes exons are skipped during the copying of the gene. Okay, sometimes exons are spliced out, and sometimes they aren't. So it's possible that one gene could code for several proteins, depending upon what parts are spliced out. And one thing you would like to know is not only where is the gene, but you'd like to know where the exons are. You'd also really like to know if there are multiple proteins that can be built from this by splicing out other exons. You'd like to know about that. Okay? And this makes life even more complicated. Any questions? Good. So, one question would be is, couldn't the problem be simplified by the computer scientists by saying, don't do it in a program, do it in a test loop? Okay? So, the problem is you don't know. DNA sequence, the genome is what we have. That's the result of the sequencing, is to give us the genome. Nature is going to somehow copy that into RNA. If we sequence the RNA that got copied, then we can figure out, you know, that will give us a good indication of where the gene was. But that means actually doing the laboratory experiment to sequence the copied RNA, rather than sequence the genome RNA. You don't, somehow, predicting the genes is really predicting what the RNA is going to do. So, computationally, it's the same problem. The real issue that we're trading off is, what is it easier to do in a computer versus what is it easier to do in a lab? Okay? And our goal is to try to identify as much as we can computationally Because in principle, although this is hard computationally, to me at least it seems like it would be harder to do in a lab.
Okay, I mean, you can answer it if you do things in a lab. So.
Any questions? Okay.
So, it's a complicated problem, but a very important problem. And actually, while we're talking about that, let's just talk about how you would do it in a laboratory. Okay? So, historically, before people had genomic sequences, historically the way people sequenced was, found genes, was to do it in the laboratory. Okay? So how might you do it in a laboratory? Well, one way that you could do it was, as we mentioned, by using things like ESTs. You can sequence, if you extract RNA from an organism, okay, and you get from the cell, you can sequence the RNA. Sequencing the RNA, if you've got it after splicing, okay, will tell you exactly what the protein is that it goes for, because that's the stuff that's left. So one thing to do is to try to do a laboratory problem exercise of sequencing RNA in addition to sequencing the genomic DNA. The genomic DNA tells you where everything might be.
If you sequence RNA, then you can do a sequence alignment. Say, hey, this RNA lines up over here. Okay, and so once I have a sequence of the RNAs, I can then do my homology searching to go back and try to find where on the genome might that gene have been. Okay, so one way to do it would have been
by sequencing the RNAs, but as we mentioned before, it's relatively difficult to get genes that way. Because first of all, you still have to do more sequencing, you have to extract the RNA and process it and all. But another problem is that since relatively few genes dominate, you know, every gene gets expressed a different amount, the genes that are highly expressed will have more RNA copies of it. Okay? Let's say that we live in a world where some genes are expressed 1,000 times more often than others. Okay? If you sample 1,000 pieces of RNA from a cell, you're not going to get 1,000 different genes. You're going to get 999 copies of one gene and one copy of another gene. Okay? And if you live in a world where your organism has 10,000 genes, 150,000 genes, you have to do a tremendous amount of RNA sequencing before you would expect to see most genes. Okay? So this is sort of a problem. Okay? There's a new technology that you start hearing about, something called mass spectrometry, which is designed to sequence proteins themselves. So we'll talk, I think, a little bit about mass spectrometry at the end, you know, later on in the semester. But a mass spectrometer is a machine that, as far as we're concerned, takes as input a protein, and as output produces the sequence of the protein. Okay, actually what it really does is it chops the protein into pieces, gives you the weight of each of the pieces, and from the weight of each of the pieces, maybe you can try to figure out what the sequence of the protein is. Mass spectrometers are very expensive things, and trying to figure out what to interpret the data is very difficult. Okay, but people always say someday this will become easy. Okay, and when it becomes easy, then you could, in principle, sequence proteins directly. And once you have the proteins, then you can go back to the genome and align it. Okay? And then, eventually, if you can do this with real proteins cheaply enough, it might eliminate the need for doing
computational gene prediction. But we're not at that point yet. Okay? Nor do I see it happening anytime in the very near future. Any questions? Okay?
So the reason why we're going to try to solve this messy, complicated gene prediction problem is because it's important. It's not because it's pretty, okay?
Okay, it's not a very pretty problem, okay?
But on the other hand, it's clear it's important, okay? And a good gene prediction program is a very important thing to have. Any questions? Okay. So, how do gene prediction programs work? There's sort of what I would say is three different approaches to gene prediction. The first one is what I'll say the first generation approach. We're basically what we would call feature-based gene prediction, which did pretty much what we talked about. So these systems like GRAIL, GeneParser, that basically identify ad hoc features of genes. Okay, basically the features we were talking about, things like just the length of the open reading frame, the codon bias, where are their start and donor and acceptor sites. Okay, and these gene prediction programs will take it as a sequence, look for all these features, okay, then try to use some kind of a dynamic programming type algorithm to walk along the genome identifying where you can find the highest scoring regions. You get a certain number of points for having a long ORF, you get a certain number of points for having a nice codon bias in between it, you get a certain number of points for having start and stop signals, okay? And based on the score that you get that is highest, okay, you know, you would output predictions. Okay? So this is one methodology that I think should be believable. And that the people in this room were forced to go off and write a gene prediction program. Based on what I've said now, you could probably go off and write a not very good gene prediction program. Okay, just using basically the technology we've talked about. Okay? It's not hard to measure how long an ORF is. It's not very hard to compute the statistics in a window. How often is there, does each triple occur? Okay? You know, it's easy to identify where the GATs and the ATGAs are. Okay? And so putting them together in some kind of a soup is how you would build a gene predictor program. And these systems exist. They are, you know, have been used quite widely. They tend to be very system species specific because they depend upon things like these codon biases, okay, that are organism specific, okay. So in fact, you probably wouldn't want to write a general yeast genome predictor here, but it might have been the case that let's say, gee, someone in this, you know, down the hall is sequencing a particular bacteria which has some particular weird properties that he knows about. Okay? And you might try to build a prediction program that's specific for that. Any questions? These feature-based prediction programs should make sense. Any questions? Okay? The second class of programs that should make sense, okay, are what I would call homology-based gene prediction. Okay? One thing that's interesting to me about biology is that biology is in some sense a finite discipline, at least as far as I am concerned. There will come a time when we no longer need biologists. Why is that? There's a finite number of species. Okay, how many species are there? 1 million, 10 million, it's finite. Okay? Each one of these species has a genome. Okay, we'll sequence it, we'll be done with sequencing. Okay? Each species has, each organism has a certain number of genes. How many genes? 10,000, 50,000, 100,000? It's finite. Okay? Eventually, all this can be known. Okay? So, what's interesting is that there's a finite number of genes in the world, different types of genes in the world. That we know. We also know that because of evolution, there is a strong similarity between the genes, the protein coding and the RNA coding genes in a particular, between nearby species. Okay? So, one class of gene prediction programs are based solely on homologies, which says that, look, I have gone through the database and identified every single gene that is somewhere annotated in the database. Okay, GenBank has umpteen million species sequences. Each sequence is annotated, so people have found genes there so far. My homology-based predictor will take as input a new sequence, and all the known gene sequences that have occurred by some definition, and will tell me where is there a similar occurrence in my new sequence to one of the known genes. Okay?
And so if you believe that eventually we will see one copy of each closely related family, of the same family of genes, then by doing this kind of similarity search, the more and more genes you have in your database, the better and better homology prediction programs should work. You know, once you have predicted, you have sequenced 1,000 species, it's likely the case that all the next 1,000 gene sequence species you have won't have very many radically new genes in it. Okay? The number of genes we have is quite similar to the number of genes mice have. Okay? So even at the distance of man and mouse, there's a great deal of similarity between our genes. Okay? So homology prediction programs,
okay, work by identifying similarity, okay, and reporting similarities of interest. Any questions? That theory should seem reasonable and logical, okay? How well do these programs work? Well, they do a good job at identifying copies of known genes, okay? What do they do a bad job of? Okay? What kind of genes would these things have a hard time finding? Yeah? Radically new genes, okay? So if you have a family of proteins that isn't well known, that has never been seen before, you are not going to discover that by doing homology, okay? Homology works when it's cheating, okay? It's like, I can't solve this homework problem, but I can copy from someone who solved it before, okay? And once enough people have put their homework on the web, then you can do this, okay? But before that, it doesn't work very well. Okay? And so, what's interesting, one thing that's very interesting, is that you would think that as time goes by, these homology prediction programs would get better and better and better, because the percentage of radically new gene structures would be known, would keep increasing. The interesting thing is that in recent years, even though there's a lot more sequence out there, the percentage of new genes that get discovered does not seem to be going down, okay? So there seem to be we're still finding lots of radically new gene structures, okay? So these homology prediction programs will not take care of the problem for many, many years. Okay, so they're a useful tool, but they don't completely solve the problem of gene recognition. Any questions? Okay? One last class of gene homology prediction program, and I promise I'll stop, are those that work by analyzing two genomes of completely different species that you don't know anything about. Let's say that when I'm analyzing the carrying man and mouse, I have this region here that is very, very similar between man and mouse. It might be the case, I don't know that this is a gene, I don't know that that's a gene, but I do know that for some reason this sequence was very, very interesting to both man and mouse. So by doing homology between species, it is possible I can identify new genes by the similarities of unknown pieces. Okay, a highly conserved region is probably interesting for some reason. Okay, and so thus I can discover new genes even though I don't know that either of them are genes. Any questions? Okay, so we've talked about two approaches to gene prediction. Next class we're going to talk about a third approach, which is based on things like hidden Markov models and neural networks, which is actually where probably the best gene prediction programs are made from today. Any questions? Okay, we'll talk about that next week. Thank you.